This is the RightsCast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company, and always streaming at rightscast.net. Maybe book sales weren't what you thought they would be. Maybe extenuating circumstances kept you from promoting the book as you wanted to. Maybe you're launching an audiobook or a graphic novel version of your original work. No matter the reason, relaunching one's book is possible, no matter how daunting it may seem. And in this episode, our guest will walk us through the why and how of his own experience doing the same. Hey there, I'm International Book Award finalist, writing coach, and RightsCast Network founder R.R. Campbell, and welcome to episode 88 of your listener-supported R.R. Campbell RightsCast here on the RightsCast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company. This episode's guest is Dan Wohl, the co-author of Death on Cache Lake, which offers a speculative take on the life lived by one of Madison, Wisconsin's infamous Sterling Hall bombers, namely that of the culprit who was never apprehended. Originally published in 2011, Death on Cache Lake has now been relaunched to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the bombing and as an homage to Wohl's co-author, John Lyon, who passed shortly before the book's initial publication. I'm thrilled to share my interview of Dan with you, but first, I'd like to talk for a moment about the intersection of art and politics. Why? Because you asked me to. Well, someone did anyway, and they did so by visiting rightscast.net/hello and submitting their question for me to tussle with as part of this episode. So let's check out the full scope of their comment. Poets have long been moved by social unrest, as have some nonfiction writers. Do you think all writers, including fiction, have a responsibility through writing and discussion groups to respond to social justice and unrest? Well, first of all, thank you to this anonymous contributor for this great question. As to whether we have a responsibility to do this, well, on that, I'm not entirely sure, but I do want to talk about how art, particularly wordcraft, is, in my view, inherently political. We're going to use two lenses to explore this, and it perhaps comes as no surprise that I will be relying on my own experience writing Accounting for It All and the books in the Empathy Sci-Fi saga, namely Imminent Dawn and Morning Dove. Why don't we start with Accounting for It All? If you're unfamiliar with this book, well, this is my debut novel, and it's the story of an adult film star turned accountant who finds herself mired in an IRS audit of a money laundering scheme she had no idea she was part of. Right, that seems like something that would be rife with opportunities to explore matters of social justice, the treatment of society's most vulnerable, educational discrepancies and how they affect interactions with the government and other groups, etc., and all of that is true. That's why, for Accounting for It All, I deliberately chose to embrace the intersection of art and politics or social justice. But rather than rely on society's prevailing narratives about those who work in pornography and sex work, I chose to research countervailing narratives that I could use to buoy the themes I wanted to explore and the point I wanted to make about the nature of self-actualization. Okay, so yeah, a lot of big stuff in there. So why don't we break that down further in order to better understand how we might approach all of this in our own work? First, let's take prevailing and countervailing narratives. We need to define them, and then we'll go on to discuss them. All right, prevailing narratives. Well, these are stories that a culture tends to tell itself about itself. Prevailing narratives often come in the form of value statements or morals that are, intentionally or not, seen as prescriptive. To deviate from these prevailing narratives is, in the eyes of the supposed majority, to betray the values of society itself and to risk becoming an outcast. Where Accounting for It All is concerned, the prevailing narratives against which our main character, Robin, finds herself pitted are those with which many of us are familiar. That those who partake in the consumption or production of pornography, or otherwise participate in sex work, are deviants, destitute, otherwise unfit to be embraced by society writ large. In other words, our society has instituted and maintained a series of statements about itself and its values that cast aspersions on those who participate in this line of work. The prevailing narrative in this case is one that says, "Hey, we don't like this, and we don't like you." Countervailing narratives, on the other hand, are those that challenge society's prevailing narratives. These are the narratives that come to the fore at times of social unrest, during protests, or oftentimes form the basis for petitions or challenges to long-standing legal or cultural precedent. In accounting for it all, the primary countervailing narrative can be distilled into a single thematic statement. Namely, that there are countless paths one might take to self-actualization, but so long as one can find happiness and become the best version of themselves that they can, that's enough. Society's expectations be damned. In this way, then, I made an active choice when writing Accounting for It All. I would choose to research, ruminate on, and then write about countervailing narratives surrounding pornography and sex work, and then explore the interplay between society's prevailing and countervailing narratives through the experiences of my main character, Robin, a young woman from Middle America who, feeling desperately out of place among the circumstances in which she was raised, pursues a career in front of and later behind the camera. Now, was this exploration an easy one to do? No. As one might expect, it's challenging to find people who are willing to talk about or argue in favor of society's countervailing narratives when it comes to topics as sensitive as these. And after having written this book, seeing it published, and having some distance between myself and the time at which I wrote it, do I still agree with every presentation I made, with every argument I took up, with every facet of the story I chose to include in order to present these countervailing narratives? I don't know. But here's the thing. My thoughts on it now don't really matter. The reader's thoughts, however, do. In presenting Accounting for It All as I have, I'm offering readers the opportunity to engage with prevailing and countervailing narratives in a private space and in a fictional world. The conclusions they choose to reach are for them, and them alone. I, as the author, factor little into how they ultimately interact with that which I wrote. The best I could, and did, hopefully do, was to write a story that lets the world know these countervailing narratives exist, and that there are people out there who are, happily, I might add, actively living them every day. What readers choose to do with these presentations in the end is completely up to them. And that brings me, actually, to the first two books in my empathy sci-fi saga, Imminent Dawn and Mourning Dove. For these books, my process was vastly different than the one I employed for Accounting for It All. In these, I had no overt political statement to make or social exploration to perform. Instead, I wanted to focus on this speculative world in which humankind was going through the first round of human trials for an internet access brain implant. My goals with the Empathy series were simple. Entertain. Use things like incredible plot twists and spellbinding suspense to keep readers turning pages. And that stance, that's an absolutely valid one to take. But here's the thing. As I started writing and as readers started reacting, it was apparent that, yes, even in the Empathy series, the dilemmas our characters face create situations where readers inevitably must tussle with moral conundrums that, at times, enter into a political space. Consider even just one of Imminent Dawn's perspective characters, the ruthless tech magnate Wyatt Hallman. In his very first chapter, he's rebuffing attempts from the North American Union government to gain access to the Empathy Internet Access brain implant he's been developing. This scene alone is teeming with political underpinnings and statements about the prevailing and countervailing narratives our society tells itself about the nature of power, what it means for something to be in, quote, the greater good, and whether one person's ambition should override the will of the people via a government that, at least in theory, has been elected by popular vote. Whether I want this subtext to be in those scenes or not, it's there. That the North American Union government exists at all is, in some ways, a political statement of sorts. In other words, the very existence of an alternative form of government forces readers to contend with the possibilities and the problems that might create, and the work then wades into the intersection of politics and social justice. And these explorations need not always be political for us to find ourselves at the crux of colliding prevailing and countervailing narratives. Consider later in Imminent Dawn, when our ruthless tech magnate Wyatt must tussle with the question of whether to shut down his research study. It's not exactly going according to plan, and that lives very well might be at risk presents an extraordinary conundrum for him. Does he shut down the study and forfeit any possibility of ushering in a new age of enlightenment, or does he press on in the name of progress and risk losing lives along the way? Personally, I think our society's prevailing narrative would suggest the study ought to be shut down. But if a new age of peace and understanding might await on the far side of the trials if they proceed, might it not be worth the loss of a few lives to see that through? I don't know. Wyatt, however, has to make a decision, and when he does, readers no doubt are left with strong feelings about him one way or the other, and the ensuing unrest and years-long battles in the name of social justice inevitably consume much of Imminent Dawn and Mourning Dove as these novels proceed. So what's the point? The point is this. Whether we have a responsibility to explore topics related to prevailing and countervailing narratives, moral proclamations, social justice, or unrest in our work is, in some ways, beside the point. No matter what we choose to write about, our work will, to some extent, inevitably find itself confronting these tough questions. Because that's fiction. That's art. And as artists, that's what we do. So thank you, anonymous listener, for that excellent question. If you, listener, have something you're wondering about in the world of reading, writing, or the writing community, visit rightscast.net/hello to share your query or comment with me. Whether you choose to do so anonymously or not is entirely up to you. I'm happy to talk out whatever you have on your mind either way. So again, that's rightscast.net/hello. Or you can tweet at us at RightsCast, leave a comment on our Instagram at RightsCast, or email us at RightsCast@gmail.com. Really, no matter how you get in touch with us, I'm happy to engage. All of that said, it's time now for my interview of Dan Wohl, whose book, Death on Cache Lake, has an inherently political underpinning, one would think, in its speculative exploration of the life of the Sterling Hall bomber who was never caught. Stay tuned after my interview of Dan for more about what you can expect next from the RightsCast Network, and thanks, as always, for listening. Thank you so much, Dan Wohl, for joining me here on the R.R. Campbell RightsCast.
Good morning.
Yeah, it is a good morning. It's a little cooler today on the date of recording, at least by me anyway. I don't know about by you, but it's been pretty hot lately, so we will take what we can get in the form of light sprinkles and a little cooler temperatures here. But, you know, Dan, we're not here to talk about the weather. No, we're talking about relaunching books, specifically in the context of your ongoing book relaunch. So why don't we start here, Dan, and talk about what are some of the reasons an author might consider relaunching their book?
Well, I guess, first of all, we broke Elmore Leonard's rule about never starting with the weather. But
I'll say that's a first for the RightsCast Network for sure. That was a hard left for me.
All right. So we'll take a mulligan on that.
Fair enough.
The book that's being relaunched is called Death on Cache Lake. It was written in 2011 by John Lyon, rest in peace, my best friend, and myself. And it was written over 20 years, and it recounts, let me back up just a little bit. If anyone's familiar with the Madison area or Wisconsin area, as a marker in Madison history is a tragedy known as the Sterling Hall bombing, which occurred in 1970. And there were four bombers. They're still on the FBI's most wanted list. Let me correct that. Three were caught. One is still on. And the great unsolved mystery of Madison, as the Wisconsin State Journal calls it, is what happened to the fourth bomber? Long story short, and we can start in wherever you want. In a fiction, you can reimagine the event and what did happen to that fourth bomber. And in the same way, use the event as a vehicle to revisit that time in our lives. It's a time that was very important to me.
Absolutely. And it sounds like you have a personal connection then, of course, to this. And that might be some of our motivation for doing a relaunch in this case. And it's certainly good to have that extra context for the book itself here. And we'll certainly get into that more as we go forward. For other authors out there who might be considering doing a relaunch of their own book, Dan, what are some reasons they might consider doing a relaunch?
Well, my opinion is it's a long shot unless you can tie it to something that is going to attract readers and give them a reason for looking at a book that was published earlier. In this case, we're approaching the 50th anniversary of this event, and it is hard to understand unless you lived in this area, but Madison is a very influential media town, and honestly, it's like the Kennedy assassination, if you're older, or 9/11. The Sterling Hall bombing is something everybody knows about, and there's going to be quite a bit of revisiting that event and wondering what happened and why it happened and how it happened. And I guess right up front, I say this all the time when I speak to audiences, I really want to make it clear that our intent was never to exploit this tragedy. It's a very touchy subject, and we don't see that we're taking advantage of it any more than, say, Stephen King was advantaging the Kennedy assassination in 11/22/63. It's a vehicle that really anchors the reader back in the late 60s and early 70s. And from there, you get into stories of the culture at the time, the politics at the time, and everything from the technology at the time to eternal ideas like loyalty between friends. So it's an event that anchors the reader in the late 60s.
And I will say, too, on your point of assuring those who are tuning in and assuring prospective readers that this isn't something that has been written in any sort of attempt to monetize or otherwise profit from this event, I will say, as someone who attended the University of Wisconsin-Madison, that even way back before I had selected the college I would be attending, I remember being on a campus tour. And when you walk past Sterling Hall and the area nearby, that's something that they highlight. And they don't highlight it as a reason that you should come to the school necessarily. What they're talking about is some of the historical context in which all of this occurred. The bombing itself occurred, the motivations for it. And they do, in fact, mention that there is one of the bombers who is still sort of out there. So this is certainly something worth exploring from the context of history. And that, it seems like, is a reason that an author might consider relaunching a book or doing a new push of promotion, is that if there is a historical tie-in or a big anniversary coming up, in this example, of course, we're talking about the 50-year anniversary of the bombing itself. So aside from that historical context, Dan, do you have any more personal reasons that you chose to relaunch this book? It sounded like you had a more personal connection perhaps to the event or to the way that the book launched the first time around.
Yeah. And just backing up, if you ask, if I had any advice for a author who's considering it, I think this idea of having an event that anchors it is important. We were also approached by a communications agent, Sharon Alden. And frankly, relaunches are kind of a long shot. So we've engaged with her to help. And I think professional help in getting your book out there is always important. So that may or may not be something your listeners would agree with. But in our case, I guess those are the two things that we think by we, I mean Sharon Alden and myself, give this thing legs. You know, I've got professional support and also it ties to an event. In terms of why I want to take this long shot, and I have other books in the work. One right now is getting pretty good play up here. It's called Paperclip. So I have other things to do, but why am I doing this now, 9 years after it was written? This book began let me know when I'm going too deep in this. But this book began in the late 80s. I was doing a lot of basically crazy things in my time off. I'm a technical rock climber. I was doing wilderness river trips up in northern Ontario, the Yukon, and reading a lot of adventure literature. James Dickey comes to mind with Deliverance. And I came back from a pretty wild trip, and I always write. And I wrote a 20, 30-page vignette about a trip gone south in Ontario. And there was a murder, and it just came out of nowhere. I wrote it, and I sent it to my best friend, John Lyon, who was living in Sauk City, Wisconsin, and I was 200 miles away. We had moved due to jobs, and I didn't hear much. A year later, I got a manuscript back from him typed on an old Selectric, and wasn't backed up with files or anything. This was 1987, and he had taken my vignette and wrapped a novel around it. And there was a lot of good stuff in it. And we went back and forth on this thing. We were full-time teachers and administrators at that point. We didn't have the chance to keep working on it. And around 2000, we had worked this thing into a finished product. And I said, John, this is just not good enough. Because at that point, the plot device was this hackneyed cliche drug deal. You write what you know about. And we don't know about big drug deals. We just don't. And it felt phony and it felt hackneyed. But there was so much good stuff in it about friendship and loyalty and the Northwoods and the small towns of the Midwest. And it just felt awful to put it aside. But we did. And caught synchronicity. But very shortly after, I went to a college reunion and this bombing came up. And I thought, wait a minute, that is something I know about. I was there. And if you take that event and throw out the drug deal plot and reimagine what happened to the lost bomber, and maybe he runs into your protagonist on a wilderness canoe trip, because the fact is that Leo Burt was last seen crossing into Canada. Now you've got a story. That's how it developed. We were in a rush to publish this, and this is a little melodramatic, but it's life. John was dying, and we took a gamble on his urging that probably was the wrong gamble. It's a really good book, and we should have gone the traditional route of querying and maybe finding an agent, but querying publishers, and that would have taken years. John wasn't sure how long he had. I found a very good independent publisher, and it came out as a Vanity Press book and was incredibly well received at the time. But there was no publishing publisher behind it, no budget, and it kind of faded away, even though it was on Wisconsin Public Radio. It was a selection at the Sterling North Book Festival. A lot of good reviews. And, you know, the irony of the whole thing was John died before it came to print. He died 1 week before the book actually appeared as a printed book. And before he had died, he said, you know, if I don't make this, Dan, this sounds melodramatic, but this is where people get their real stories in life. He said, will you promise me you'll give this book another try? And I said, sure. And, you know, he died, and I'm a really patient guy. And I thought about it. I said, well, I'm just not going to dig deeper while I'm in a hole. I'm going to let this thing rest. And I got thinking about the 50th, and I made a little promise to myself that in 2020, on the 50th anniversary, I'd give it one last try. Not only because I owe John, he was my best friend, but honestly, it's a good book. I've never given it to anyone who hasn't liked it, and I could share with your audience some of the reviews from major outlets, and the vice president of the National Book Club Circle, Dave Wood, is one of its biggest fans, for example.
Thank you. This episode of the R.R. Campbell Writescast is brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing. Dandelion Web Marketing helps writers like you build a thriving author platform through strategic web marketing. If you're not sure if you're on the right track with your website, well, one of Dandelion Web Marketing's author website audits can help you find out. Listeners of the Writescast Network right now can also take 50% off one of these audits. They'll look at your site's content, its security, design, search engine optimization, and more, and they'll provide you with insight into what you might do to better connect with your audience. So to learn the strengths and weaknesses of your current website and take half off along the way, you can visit dandelionwebmarketing.com/writescast to learn more. That's dandelionwebmarketing.com/writescast.
Wow. Well, it seems like really, first I'll say this, you know, I am sorry for your loss. I know that that was some years ago by now, but it is really a fascinating story behind the story. And even knowing that this wasn't something that you set out to write together in terms of it being about the Sterling Hall bomber in the first place and knowing how the book evolved over time and that both of you were willing to be patient with allowing the story to develop as it needed to develop. I mean, it seems like there is so much motivation here, of course, both personal and historical, to go into a sort of relaunch. You also talk about having fantastic reviews, and something that you mentioned in there had my brain, you know, churning a little bit as other reasons that other authors out there might consider a book relaunch. And this is one that I will say personally, I am sort of tussling with right now, because Dan, I was fortunate enough to just this last week prior to our recording this to have my debut science fiction novel, Imminent Dawn, named as a finalist in the International Book Awards. And this was a really wonderful, unexpected honor for a book that I've had a hard time marketing and promoting with the world as it is right now, and knowing kind of what goes on in that book and in that series. But this is, to me, I'm looking at this, Dan, and I'm hearing your story. You and I have been in touch back and forth here. We've been in touch through Sharon by email for a few weeks, if not months. And I'm looking now at my own work and saying, well, hey, this might be another opportunity to do a relaunch if I'm able to really pick up the steam in a quick hurry here and get it out in the world. So these are all things that might motivate a relaunch. But Dan, were there any things that, aside from some of what you've mentioned already, what are some of the things that you have considered before doing this new relaunch? What was it that you perhaps looked to do, or what were going to be your markers for success here?
I'd like to just back up on touch on one thing you said, if I could, because I thought about this a lot. And congratulations on your book award. It sounds great. I'll have to get the title afterwards. I'm a science fiction fan too.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. And it's Imminent Dawn for listeners out there who might want to know as well.
Very cool. Imminent Dawn. But if I heard you correctly, you said your plans got knocked awry a little bit with the situation we have in our country right now with COVID. And I'm sure you agree that can't really complain, because here we are healthy. I hope you're healthy and I'm healthy, and so many people are not. But I've probably had to cancel a half a dozen in-person interviews that were set up months ago, a lot of them in the Madison area because of this. And I don't know if you experienced that too. So it sort of had to, as writers that are now in the back half of writing, which is getting people to give your work a chance, we kind of need to look to alternate ways. And so these interviews I'm doing, like this interview with right now, are very interesting. So I got a little off track there, but I just thought what you said was interesting about COVID. So maybe you need to reorient me to the original question.
Yeah, please. And I'll actually, before we reorient back to that question, actually, I'll kind of pick that up and run with it, because it is true that COVID has certainly had an effect on the way that I've had to approach my sort of bread and butter marketing efforts. I really feel that one of my strengths as an author is having the opportunity to get in front of a room of people at a writing conference or at a bookstore event, whatever the case might be. And I'll say that even some of the struggles I had promoting this series predate COVID, and they actually kind of dip into the broader political landscape, especially since 2016 that we've been living in, where when I originally wrote this book, a lot of the themes that I was treating in Imminent Dawn, and in fact, some of the events that I chose to feature were, at the time I was writing them, very prescient. You know, they were ahead by what would turn out to be only a handful of years, as opposed to the 30 or 40 years that I might have baked into the book. And I think that it's one thing when you're writing science fiction that is getting out into the world and folks can look at that and go, oh my goodness, I mean, that's really dark. I can't imagine that. I can see how we might get there, but wow, to think that that could be our reality. And that's one thing. But then when you have to start living that and the news cycle is reflecting your fiction, well, you might need a break from the news cycle, and trying to get into that, into the world of fiction, was one of the challenges that I found myself facing. But knowing that there are folks out there who are apparently interested, or at least finding value in this book and the series as a kind of reflects some of what we're actually seeing now, as opposed to 20 to 40 years down the line. Well, that's the motivation, I think, that's kind of getting me geared up for this perspective relaunch, or at least a new wave of promotion. So just broader context there for listeners. But Dan, just to kind of back up then to the question that I had posed a little earlier, was we've talked a little bit about some of the considerations that you have put into relaunching this book. For example, working with Sharon as a publicist is one of those things. What are some of the other considerations that you wanted to make sure you took into account before undertaking this relaunch?
Well, I think the obvious one is you have to be committed to your book, and you have to love your work. This may sound hard to believe, but I don't think I would want to get behind a book that I didn't believe in, even if it was successful. So I think all of us who are writing, we're proud of our work, and this one in particular, you know, I'm really proud of it. So there's the, you know, the personal end of it, but the other end of it is I never thought it got a fair shake because of what happened to my friend and his death. And I've gone the other route. My current book, Paperclip, has a publisher, Burning Bowl Publisher, and you know, it's doing a little better having a publisher behind it. They put it on audiobooks right away, stuff like that. So I think if you're thinking about relaunching it, just the main thing is you have to believe in your work, and you have to know that it's a long shot and be willing to take a risk.
Kill Your Darlings Candle Company has partnered with the RightsCast Network to give away 3 of their candles for the wordsmiths of the world throughout the month of August 2020. That's right, you can get either their Kill Your Darlings Dramatic Irony or Happily Ever After candles for free if you're the first person to email them at contact@kydcandleco.com and share this episode's secret word. And this episode's secret word is wick. Yes, wick, as in the blend of cotton you'll burn when you let Kill Your Darlings Candle Company brighten your path to the page. So email Kill Your Darlings Candle Company at contact@kydcandleco.com and use the word wick in the subject line to win one of this month's free candles. Again, that word is wick. To learn more about Kill Your Darlings Candle Company and their quest to sustainably illuminate the lives of writers, readers, and their communities, visit kydcandleco.com. That's kydcandleco.com. And I think that that's something that a lot of listeners might hear and feel a little bit daunted by, but maybe it's worth taking a moment here to just remind listeners that it is an audacious act to sit down and write a book in the first place. You know, you are taking a risk every time you sit down and look at that blank page and think to yourself, I have a story here that is worth writing and is worth publication one day. I just know it. I mean, you are already embracing a certain amount of risk. And so having already made the investment of time in a story that you believed in, having put in those long hours of drafting and revision, you know, you might hear Dan and I talking about how daunting it is to undergo a relaunch and what a risk that is, but you've already taken so many. If you believe in this book, as we would hope you do, as Dan believes in Death on Cache Lake and the relaunch here, then hey, you know, a relaunch is probably more within grasp than you might realize, at least at first glance. So that would be my thought on it anyway, and just to give more context to Dan, because we've talked now about what it is we might consider before we relaunch, what has the relaunch process looked like for you this time around here?
The only reason I hesitate is you keep touching the third rail of my writing with your topics. So I've just got to say,
please do.
You're really in my wheelhouse when you talk about it. It takes a kind of a courage to write, and I would encourage the listeners to be courageous. And I always say this when I talk in libraries. Sometimes people come up and say, "I'd like to write," and I would say, don't worry about being afraid, because it's different, I think, than any other kind of art. I mean, poetry or music, the emotion is implied and it's wonderful, but it's still implied. And I'm telling you, if you write, you put it right out there in black and white, and it's only in print forever. So maybe that's another thing we ought to add in, is you need to be a little bit of a risk taker. And I think you're kind of a more optimistic personality. I guess I'm not pessimistic, but I'm a realist. I think of people like James Lee Burke that, you know, he sent his books out 128 times in a row over I don't know how many years before he got one picked up. Or I think of James Toole with The Confederacy of Dunces, really probably one of the greatest novels of the 20th century. And he died, and the manuscript sat in his closet until his mother relaunched it, you know? So, if you're writing solely to make money and be successful, I kind of feel sorry for you. I think your first consideration, I'm not talking to you personally, to any author out there, is you've really got to want to do it. It's just like rock climbing or piano. It's got to be a passion that you want to do. And writing is a passion for me. So, about the relaunch. So what was the question? How do you begin?
Well, and I'll touch too on something you said in there about this idea of being a realist. And I think that that is really important. And I know that in this show and elsewhere online, you can see a lot of optimism thrown out into the sort of a writer's sphere. And I think that that comes from a place of knowing that when we undertake writing, when we try to get in the querying process, whatever the case is, we're going to face a lot of rejection. And so I think there are so many ways that writers seek to lift each other up. But Dan, to your point, being a realist is also really important here, because a relaunch for a book, or even just undergoing the querying process, or deciding perhaps that it's time to set a project aside for a while, maybe pick it up again in a few years and give it another shot, whatever it is, it's important we be realistic, because unchecked optimism can actually also, though it might help us in the short run, can set us up to get kind of hurt in the long run. And so I'm sure, Dan, and this kind of leads me into my question for you here, I'm sure that you had to be very realistic when you decided you were going to undertake the relaunch process. And so what did that process sort of look like? What were the early steps in deciding to relaunch this book?
Not to be a broken record, but again, to believe in it. Then I went to my kind of a go-to, I guess, strength of my life, and I'm by no means, a paragon of expertise in this, but networking. So I started to ask myself, if I'm going to do this, who's going to help? Because it's hard to go it alone. I'm not a genius, and I have a good book here, but there's a lot I don't know. So I started to put my networks together, and you know, if you've been writing a lot and associating with writers and listening to shows like this and getting into the culture, you're going to meet people. And I think those networks are very, very important. So I mentioned over the course of time, I said he's the vice president of the National Critics Book Circle, Dave Wood. I should have said he's retired. But he was, and he's met every author that you can imagine, from Kurt Vonnegut to James Dickey, and he knows a lot about this. So I started with him, and I kind of double-checked myself on, do you think this is worthwhile? And he said, absolutely. And then I've got some other friends who have given me a chance to share my work. Al Ross runs a Wisconsin public radio show up here called Spectrum West. He encouraged me. So I guess the second step is you go out there with your work and check it with your network and see what they say, because you know, a true friend is one who warns you. And, you know, I think if a good friend will say, honestly, Dan, I don't think so. But everybody I talk to, and this includes a lot of authors more successful than I, said, you really ought to try it again, because it really is an interesting book that talks of about a once-in-a-lifetime event that is relevant to a lot of people. And underneath it, there's this whole North Woods adventure thing. There's living in small town Wisconsin. And there's this sort of feel. I don't know your personal demographic, Ryan, but in my case, I go back to being a kid and watching this old black and white TV series called The Fugitive, the original one. And that was in the late 60s with David Janssen. And that sort of early noir feel is pervasive in this book. So it wasn't, everyone I said, you've got kind of a unique tale here. You should give it a shot. So I guess what we've got is, do you believe in your book? And then the second step, I think, is you need some other eyes on it, even if they've read it before, and you need other opinions on whether it's worth doing. Then if you're working with a professional, that would be my third step. You know, they're out there to make money, but I think your professionals of integrity, they're not going to take your money if the work doesn't have any chance at all. So, you know, a good agent, ad agency never hurts, I think. And it's certainly, in my case, gotten me a lot of opportunities that I would have trouble getting myself.
So it seems like we've got at least three steps there that folks can consider maybe taking a look at if they're deciding to go into the relaunch and then actually executing those if they feel like it's going to be a good fit. What I want to know now, Dan, is how did this relaunch and how, as it continues to advance here, how does it contrast with the initial launch for the book? How have these two processes diverged, and perhaps how have they looked similar to one another?
Well, the first one was colored by John's failing health. And we were so obsessed with writing the book before he died, frankly, that we didn't give much thought to what would happen after it was done, other than he convinced me that we should go with a vanity press route on it. And so it came out, and shared it with friends in Madison, and immediately got kind of a buzz. Doug Moe, columnist for the State Journal, and probably the man that knows as much about this event as anyone from a journalistic standpoint, got a hold of it and gave it a push. I mentioned a couple of other people. There's a pretty well-regarded book festival in Wisconsin called the Sterling North Book Festival, named after the old author of Rascal. And it was picked as a feature selection there. You know, it had just floated around with friends, and someone sent it off to them, and they picked it as a feature selection. I remember I got to meet Michael Tucker and Jill Eikenberry. They were in the old L.A. Law Show, because they had written a book that was chosen as the first selection. And so I sat at the head table with them. So it felt like it was just going, and I didn't do anything. And then Wisconsin Public Radio called up, and there's a popular show, your Madison listeners will know this, called the Larry Mueller Show. He's been on forever.
Oh, love Larry. Larry's great.
Yeah. And he had me on right before Packer great Willie Davis, who I think passed away, bless his heart. But yeah, I was on for a whole hour, and I don't know if you've ever been in Larry's studio. But the way it works is you're sitting there with the headphones on, and there are monitors, TV monitors. And as calls come in, they're kind of lined up. So you get a little heads up what's happening. It'll say Jim from Avoca or something like that. Well, I had a whole hour, and I got to talk about the book for 10 minutes. And then the calls kind of overwhelmed them. And I never got to talk about the book anymore because everybody wanted to call in and talk about their personal experience with this event, which was really fun. I would have liked to talk about the book, but it certainly was an indicator of how interesting this topic is. You know, people would call and say, well, I actually played Frisbee with him a day afterwards. You know, all kinds of stories. Wow. You know, I saw him in a Dairy Queen 2 years later. Stuff like that.
It's like the legend of Bigfoot, you know, someone has him on grainy footage somewhere at a Dairy Queen, you know, they were the last time that they saw the guy and they didn't know he was a suspect at the time. That's really great to know that you had that sort of interactivity, you know, especially on that debut launch and especially through a venue like the Larry Mueller Show, because I know that Larry is, I mean, WPR has a lot of great programming, but he's really a bright spot every day. And I know that he gives a really great interview, even if you didn't get to talk as much about your book as you might have liked.
Well, it's a wonderful experience. He's a treasure. Yeah.
Yeah. He's absolutely great. And Dan, I'll say, you know, you've had a lot of folks reaching out via the phone lines on the Larry Mueller Show. What kind of response have you had so far to the relaunch this time around? What has the interactivity looked like with folks, especially considering you are relaunching this during the midst of the quarantines, as I like to call them?
I would say it's mostly regional. And by regional, I mean Northwest Wisconsin. And it's been strong, but it's also a little conflated with the fact that I just published another co-written book, and I don't want you to think all my work is co-written, called Paperclip. And that has gotten some play up here. We have an independent paper called Volume 1 out of Eau Claire.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I know them.
They did a big story on it, and the Eau Claire Leader gave it a full page in its variety section.
Oh, cool.
And I was interviewed. So I'm actually having a little trouble separating, like, are people interviewing me up here because of Paperclip or Death on Cache Lake? But I'll be real honest, the biggest handicap, and I want to say this correctly because my heart goes out to people that are suffering with COVID because of health or their employment or whatever. But wow, what a time to be an author trying to get a book out there, because something that's really important are these speaking engagements in libraries. And it's just not happening as a result of this.
It's not, but I'll say this, you know, Dan, between some of the experiences you've mentioned with things like interviews and some of what I've mentioned in terms of social media outreach, we do actually also have an entire episode dedicated to this topic. This is for listeners here. If you want to learn more about launching a book in the middle of all of this, you can head back a couple of episodes to my interview of Claribel Ortega, who is the author of Ghost Squad. Her book was slated, of course, to come out for a year or two now. And then it just so happened that as her book was being released, it was either late March or early April. That was just as everything got shut down. And so she was in a position where she had to sort of scramble to get everything that she had planned adjusted and to do so in a really tight timeline. And I was fortunate enough to be able to interview her shortly before she did her all digital book launch. And I know that it's not the same, you know, as being able to get up in front of a room of 100 people, 150 people, 10 people, whatever the case might be. It's not the same, but Claribel has had some really wonderful success as she's continued to promote this book during these times. So listeners, that might be a really great opportunity for you to go back a few episodes and tune into that interview of Claribel, because I think that there's a lot to be learned, and there are certainly ways that we can still push forward with this promotion, like Dan has, like Claribel has, like I have with my own work. So, hey, there are resources out there, you know?
Yeah, it's a great time to be a writer if you want to look at it from another way, because people are starved for things to do. So as I kind of review what I've been talking about for the past half hour, I hope I don't come off as discouraging any writers who are out there. First of all, if you're a writer, you're on my side. And I'll tell you, if there's anything, almost use an expletive here, that angers me rather than P word. If anything that makes me angry, it's writers that don't support other writers. So I support other writers. And if you're out there trying to get something going, well, do it. And network and find shows like this and find writers that you can get together with, even if it's virtually, or maybe you sit outdoors 6 feet away and have coffee once a month or twice a month, and strengthen each other and keep going. So, man, if I've tried to sound like I'm dampening the spirits of writers here in this by being realistic, I am not. And I would, in fact, you know, I'll congratulate anybody who's taking the time to listen to this broadcast and trying to learn something from a author up here in the North Woods who writes about 1970.
Book promotion is hard enough. There's no reason to make it any harder. And oftentimes, a reader's first impression of your book is from its cover. But rather than pay a professional photographer hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars to take high-quality photos of your book, well, I'm going to let you in on a secret. That secret is called mock-up shots. Mock-up Shots is an online software by Adazing that lets you upload your covers to create high-quality images of your books for marketing and publicity purposes. Personally, using Mock-up Shots has helped me further develop my brand and sharpened my web presence, whether that be on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or my author website. And Mock-up Shots has saved me tons of time. Whenever I need a stunning new photo of one of my books, I can simply hop into Mock-up Shots and generate one in minutes. If it sounds awesome, that's because it is. So right now you can take 60% off mock-up shots if you head to bit.ly/coverphotosdeal right now. You can get access to hundreds of incredible images that your book can be featured in, all if you visit bit.ly/coverphotosdeal right now. And every month, Adazing adds additional photos to mock-up shots, so you'll never run out of high-quality content you can use to promote your book. So again, visit bit.ly/coverphotosdeal to take 60% off mock-up shots right now. Well, and I actually, my next question for you, Dan, was going to be what words of encouragement you could offer to authors who might be thinking a book relaunch is going to be daunting. And I'll say, you know, I think that being realistic, very important. And I don't think that you have been dampening the spirits of anyone, at least I'll speak for myself in a way, you haven't been dampening my spirits. If anything, Dan, I think knowing the story of what brought this book to fruition, I think knowing the obstacles that it faced during its initial launch, and then knowing that you've been able to get some nice traction here as you have relaunched the book is really a boon. At least it is to me anyway, insofar as knowing that a relaunch is possible is concerned. So Dan, I don't know if you have any other final words that you want to leave with our audience here that would encourage them to, I don't know, keep their chin up if they're considering a relaunch. But if you'd like to share those, please go ahead.
Well, I guess the one thing I would say to people in my position and possibly your position is kind of like the fable of the lion with the thorn in its paw, and the mouse pulls it out, and then the lion never forgets it. Is as you're getting going, you're going to get some feedback, and they're going to be from all kinds of people. And unless you're John Sanford or somebody like that, I don't think you can afford to fail to thank the people that have reached out to you. And maybe they send you an email and you don't feel like answering it, but you should. You know, I talked about reviews, and I'll let you go after this, but I just wanted to tell one story. You know, probably the most important review I ever got was not from Dave Wood. It was not from Wisconsin Public Radio. It was not from the Star Tribune. It was not from, you know, any of these major outlets, even though I've gotten nice reviews from those places. I was doing a reading up north, and an old logger afterwards, he came up to me in blue jeans and says, there's a scene in Death on Cache Lake with a bar fight in a roadhouse bar way up north. And he's in his 70s, and he said to me, you know, I think I was there that night for the fight.
Wow, that's funny. That's great.
I said, well, I made that up, you know. And he was was just convinced he had been there. So, you know, I took the time to really chat with him for, oh man, I must have talked for 20 minutes. And so I would say, as you're writing, you know, encouragement is kind of the super fuel that we go on. So, you know, thank the people that read your work, and thank you notes are important. And, you know, if you do get a Zoom interview or a library interview, make sure you give it 100%.
Absolutely. And really treasure, like you shared there in that story, really treasure the one-to-one interactions, because I think it's very easy for us as authors to look at something like book sales or to look at the quantity of the reviews that we have coming in and maybe feel a little bit dismayed or wondering whether or not it's worth it. But then you have these interactions, whether it is at a book event or you get an email from someone who really enjoyed your work. Those are the moments that you have to hold close, because that's the stuff that, like you say, those are the moments of super fuel that can keep you going. Whether you have 1,000 reviews, whether you have 10 reviews, or whether that's just your first review, that's a moment. And that's a personal connection that I think is something that can't be replicated anywhere, no matter whatever your numbers might be for sales or reviews. So I'm really thankful that you shared that story with us here as we sort of wind down our conversation. But before we do let you go, Dan, I do want to have you let listeners know, if you wouldn't mind, where is it that they can find you and find Death on Cache Lake and find Paperclip and your other work? Where can they find that online?
DanWall.com is a site that it's also being relaunched. So it's out there. It's not in its finished version. I'm a big believer in independent bookstores. That's my go-to. There are most of them up here, but I'm also, again, a realist. So most of my sales right now are on Amazon. And then by hand, in River Falls where I live, there's a small local pharmacy that I love, and they feature local authors. We have quite a few authors up in this neck of the woods. And I have my books there, and I'm proud to say that those books, anyone who buys a book there, the proceeds go to our free clinic. So I would say, if you're up here, there are some independent stores, but otherwise I would say it's your outlets like Amazon. There was something else I was going to say, but I don't remember. So yeah, if you read the book, you know, I'm retired. I'm 71. I've got time. If you have a question for me, my email's lcapdan@yahoo.com, lcapdan@yahoo.com. El Cap is the name of a mountain, El Capitan, and I climbed it way, way back, and it's always been a marker in my life.
I was wondering if that was the motivation for that email address. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, nobody really cares that I climbed that mountain, just like I didn't get famous like Alex Honnold, but I'll never regret one moment of it. And I never regret a moment of any of my writing either. So please, thanks for having me on the show. And I hope Imminent Dawn and Death on Cache Lake get the attention they deserve.
I certainly hope for the same as well. I will say, Dan, that if I hadn't already been convinced to pick up a copy of Death on Cache Lake, I will certainly be doing so after our conversation here today. So thank you, Dan, as well, for joining me for this episode of the R.R. Campbell Writes Cast.
Been a pleasure.
That'll do it for my interview of Dan Wall, the co-author of Death on Cache Lake. Thanks to Dan for joining me, and thanks to you, dear listeners, for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd love it if you could leave the Writes Cast Network a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. This will help the WritesCast Network reach more writers like you, and building that sense of community is what we, and I hope you, are all about. To those of you who have already left us a rating and review, thank you. I'd also like to thank the WritesCast Network's patrons who contribute to our programming financially at patreon.com/WritesCast. In exchange for their support, WritesCast Network patrons get access to some great patron perks, including WritesCast swag like stickers, t-shirts, and mugs, discounts on my editing services, and entries in monthly drawings for partial manuscript critiques performed by yours truly. If this sounds like something you'd be interested in, you can join patrons like Laura Hazen and Angeline Boley today in supporting our programming directly at $1, $2, or $3 per episode or per month. Any level of contribution will get you access to some of those fantastic patron perks, so become a supporter today by making your pledge at patreon.com/writescast. That's patreon.com/rightscast. Thanks as well to our on-air sponsors, Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company. To learn more about them or our other sponsors, you can visit rightscast.net/sponsors. Coming up on the Rightscast Network is the final episode of Profiles in Encouragement for 2020. Tune in on August 28th when authors like Tracy S. Phillips, Lori Dennis, and Josie Thomas share their words of encouragement with the writing community. I'll also have a story of my own to share, so don't miss it. In the meantime, say hello on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Rightscast or by searching for the Rightscast Network. We're also available by email at rightscast@gmail.com, and you can now call us at area code 608-284-8342, where you can leave a voicemail with questions for future guests or other matters you'd like us to address in our programming. Again, that number is 608-284-8342. To reach me personally, you can visit rrcampbellwrites.com or holler at me on Twitter as I am RR Campbell. I love hearing from listeners of all backgrounds, so please don't hesitate to reach out. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, this is RR Campbell signing off. Write on and write well. This is the Rightscast Network. Brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company. And always streaming at rightscast.net.